Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zemer. It's my privilege to serve as a minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by Carolyn Andrews Schlemmer, who's serving as our worship associate, our interim director of religious education, Karen Labracco, our music director, Hal Walker, and our Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent Peace Choir.
We light this chalice to show us the way toward equity and compassion in human relations and to help us build a world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. Church exists to proclaim the gospel that each human being is infinitely precious, that the meaning of our lives lies hidden in our interactions with each other. We wish to be a church where we encounter each other with wonder, appreciation, and expectation, where we call out of each other's strengths, wisdom, and compassion that we never knew we had.
And usually I'm speaking from here to you, but today is a very different day. Today we will be in conversation. So today's a day that not only can you talk in church, but you're encouraged to speak up. We're going to be talking today about what's equal and what's fair in our world and in our community. Now, how many of you have ever had anything happen to you that felt like it was unfair? Anybody? Yeah, you know, that's happened for most of us. Now, here's a really deep question. Is fair the same as being equal? No? Yes? What do you think? Remember? You can hear, yeah?
No.
No. Okay. But we're not maybe exactly sure. So, in true scientific method, what we're going to do is do a little experiment, a demonstration, so we will find out for ourselves whether indeed fair is the same as equal. Now, to do this demonstration, I will need two volunteers and a bag of cookies. And Reverend Melissa is going to help me here with all our volunteers. So I need two volunteers.
Evan and Raylan, both of you.
You could come up here. All right. Excellent. Okay. If you could take... All right, and one for you. Now, what I have here, as you can see, they each have a plate, and I have 10 cookies. If you could look there, I'm going to show. I'm going to do one, two, three, four, five, six, 7, 8, 9, and 10. Okay. Now, how many cookies do you have on each of your plates?
Five.
Now, if I started with 10 cookies and they've got 5 on each plate, is that equal?
Yes.
Oh, good job. All right. Is that fair?
Yes.
Sounds fair enough. Okay. All right. Let me ask, what did you have for breakfast this morning?
Eggs.
Eggs, okay. And you?
Oatmeal.
Oatmeal, okay. So are those breakfasts, you know? What do you think now? If one has eggs and one has oatmeal for breakfast, is it still fair that each could have 5 cookies?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. Now, maybe what time you had breakfast, maybe that would make a difference in how hungry you are right now. So, on a scale of 1 being, I can't stand it, I'm so hungry, or I'm really, really full, where would you say you're at?
Hungry.
Hungry. Really hungry? Really hungry, looking at those cookies, all right. And what about you?
Kind of full.
Kind of full, okay. Now, if we've got somebody really hungry and somebody kind of full, then is it fair that she should have an equal number of cookies? What do you think? They're equal, but is it fair? Is that the right thing that we should be doing here?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Hmm? But shouldn't the hungry person get more cookies? Don't you think? I mean, she's really hungry. Would that be fair?
Yes.
Or not?
Yes.
No, I don't know. It's getting a little complicated now. What do you think? Is that fair for you to get more? Okay. Is it fair for her to get more?
No.
No. Oh, my gosh. It's a little complicated here. Okay. All right. Okay. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to send you back to your place, and we're going to get someone else up here. An adult. Yeah. All right. Do we have another volunteer?
I think we need somebody who's much bigger than Raylan who
yes,
can be a volunteer.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Let's see. Can we have two to share this one plate? Is that too complicated?
That's too complicated.
That's too complicated.
Sorry.
All right. Let's have William.
Oh. Oh. Okay. Well, you could call it. All right. Okay. All right, so let's take a look at these two people here, okay? They look to be different sizes to me. Now, is it fair for people who are different sizes to get the same number of cookies?
As long as they're smaller than me, then.
What's that?
As long as they're smaller than me.
As long as they're... Okay, so that's one approach. Now, some would say that if you're smaller, you need fewer because you're not so big and you don't need so many. So, well, maybe it'd be better just to give a bigger person more. Yes, would that be?
Yeah.
And then others would say that if you're bigger, especially if you're a grown-up, you can go out and buy your own cookies anytime you want. And you can earn more in allowance, and maybe it would be better for the younger person to have more. Oh, gosh. Now, I have a question. These are ginger snaps. Do both of you like ginger snaps?
Okay,
but but you like it. Okay. Alrighty. All right. But not everybody likes ginger snaps, and not everybody can eat ginger snaps because they're allergic to it or something. So I'm going to say thank you so much, and I would like someone to come up here who doesn't like ginger snap cookies. Okay. Or can't eat them. Or can pretend that they don't like ginger snap cookies.
Okay, Saunas.
All right, thank
Saunas
you,
doesn't
Saunas.
Like ginger snaps.
She doesn't. Yes. So Saunas, she doesn't like these ginger snap cookies at all. So what do you think? Would it be fair that the plates look like this?
Yep.
What do you think?
No.
No? Well, then what can we do?
Different cookies.
Different cookies. Oh, my gosh. That might be a way. But you know, what's so amazing here is that when we talk about being equal, it sounds really simple. And actually, that equality is the basis of our values. When we talk about equality, we talk about equal rights, and it's the basis of our inherent worth and dignity of each and every person. But when we get into being fair, it gets a little bit more complicated. And those are those really hard questions that we grapple here and the children grapple with in their religious education programs every week.
Like never before, the presence of the other in all its beauty, fragility, dignity, and need is demanding our answers. These questions, if entertained, might demand that we change our theologies, liturgies, and practices. The bondage of certainty can supplant the freedom of faith and make it impossible for us to say, we don't know, we apologize, we want to change. What can we do to make things right? The heart of a religion that will bless the world is going to beat at its edges.
Thank you.
A new year lies stretched before us, open, unwritten, filled with so many possibilities. It's enough to kindle our capacity for hope. What if we let that move in our own lives? What if we let the movement of time move in our own lives, recognizing that before us this year lies open, unwritten, and filled with possibilities? The way it was does not need to be the way it will become. We can do something new. We can dream new dreams. We can chart new courses for ourselves and in beloved community. Grant us the courage to dream, the faith to hope, the will to work, and the patience to sustain ourselves as step by step we walk forward into this new year. Amen. Have any of you ever seen a PBS documentary special called People Like Us? It was on a few years ago. A few of you have seen it. It's a documentary about social class in the United States. And I wanted to show you some images from that documentary today, and I appear to have broken my computer trying to help you see these things. Last night I was taking clips, and I was trying to spare you the stopping and starting, and I think I infected my computer with a virus. So you have to use your imagination. And I shared these clips with Carolyn, and I invited her to give us just a brief, her brief response about how she felt after seeing these clips, knowing that that is what happens to us when we see something like this. We formulate our response, and I thought it might be helpful to hear one spoken aloud. So the first episode that I wanted to show you is called Tammy's Story, and it's about a woman who lives in Waverly, Ohio, in a rural area in a trailer that is clearly run down, has seen better days. And she lives there with her two children and works at Burger King to support them. She doesn't have a car or a driver's license, so she has to walk to Burger King, where she is a janitor. And the episode shows us the ways in which poverty pervades their lives and the limited access to opportunity that she has.
On the news and in real life, I'm confronted, we all are, with true stories about living in poverty that I would find unendurable, many even worse than Tammy's. And I have whole layers of responses, some of which make me a little uncomfortable. My first thought is, ain't it awful? People shouldn't have to live like that in the richest nation in the world. Could I do what Tammy does to support her family? She works very, very hard. She still gets blamed and harassed and embarrasses her children because she's poor. Another response that I notice is way too close to blaming the victim. Why doesn't she at least clean up her yard? Well, my other, more logical self kicks in and says, would I have the energy to clean up the yard and plant flowers and get rid of all that trash after a day of work, feeding two kids, walking 21 miles, 10 and a half miles each way to work in the rain in the video? Well, another one is, her son's teeth are terrible. They're all kind of, and she looks like she's speaking just with gums. Doesn't she know to go to the dentist regularly? And that other little voice kicks in and says, cleaning toilets at Burger King probably doesn't come with dental. Well, can't she at least walk facing traffic? Well, she should walk facing traffic, actually. I also respond by thinking, what could I do? If I had one of her sons in my English class, one of the few ways I can imagine myself acquainted with her family, since I kind of live in a little bubble, could I do anything to help, or should I? I couldn't handle them thinking of me as a person to come to anytime they need help. I mean, that would get really bad quickly. And if I could, even in this one instance, what about all those other people living in poverty? And all the discomfort of those thoughts leads to me the response, let's not think about that for now. Sometimes it morphs into what's called compassion overload. All those people, all those needs. So finally I end up thinking, okay, I'll make a token response. I'm going to give something to Kent Social Services, and then I'll stop thinking about it. You probably agree with me. None of these responses is very helpful or useful.
So the next clip I wanted to show you takes place in New York in the Hamptons, and there are scenes of multi-million dollar mansions and I think it's a polo tournament. Is that a polo tournament? And the champions being crowned and this big banquet with beautiful white tents on expansive lawns overlooking the ocean and people being served drinks and hors d'oeuvres. And a man at this party is interviewed about being there, and he says, you know, there's a certain comfort in knowing that everybody here worked hard, and that's why we're at the top, and it feels good to be rewarded for that effort.
The beginning of that clip shows two women talking in the back of a convertible. She says, well, there's the North Hamptons and the East Hamptons and the South Hamptons. And the other woman said, well, there's Hampton Beaches. Oh, we don't consider that the Hamptons. I mean, really, electricians live there. So how would you respond to seeing the beautiful people? Well, we see it all the time. You don't even need to see that clip. We see variations of lifestyles and the rich and famous all over TV. And people must like to watch them because there are more and more of them. One of my reactions, I'm embarrassed to admit, is envy for the life, the power, the money, the comfortable lives they lead. Although, of course, not for their conspicuous consumption and their arrogance. If you or I had that much wealth, we'd handle it much better, wouldn't we? But my much stronger reaction is this. Don't they get it? Don't those bleepity bleeping bleeps, and I'm getting, well, I was going to use real bleeps there, but don't they understand? Burger King does almost $2.5 billion worth of business a year, and their profit margin is almost 8%, some of which probably made its way into the bank accounts of some of these one percenters. Our nation, our civilization can't stay healthy when such a small group of people skim off more and more and more of the cream. What can be done to make them understand that? Well, my personal recurring fantasy is to make the Koch brothers live in Tammy's trailer, live Tammy's life, even in Tammy's body, until they understand real life. So I react with a combination of envy and disgust, plus frustration and fantasy. Not very helpful or useful responses either.
It's hard to talk about economic inequality without talking about percentages and numbers, and it can be hard to visualize percentages and numbers in our minds. So I have a little representation for us. We're going to look at changes in family income between 1979 and 2012 in the United States. And just to make sure we're all on the same page, income includes things like paychecks and earned interest, Social Security checks, rent from owning real estate, capital gains from selling investments, dividends, and stocks, among other things. And when economists talk about income in the United States, they often talk in terms of quintiles. So I have here the representation of the quintiles from 2002. The bottom quintile, people made from nothing up to 28,000, and the second from 28 to 50, from the middle from 50 to 76 and a half, in the fourth from 76 and a half to 119,000, and in the top 119,000 and up. So these are the quintiles that economists used in 2012 when measuring income. And I'd like to show you, using these blocks here, what happened to the income for each of these quintiles over that 30-plus year period. And I have three blocks for each one, not because they were all the same when we started, of course, in 1979, they weren't, but we just need to draw a line, right? Like, imagine that they're all in a line and you're going to play Mother May I. So this is just arbitrary. This is just an arbitrary, imaginary starting place from which to measure. And each of these blocks represents a 5% change in income. Okay, you with me? All right. So between 1979 and 2012, this is what happened. The people in the lowest quintile, their income actually went down by 12%. So I'm going to take away 2.5 blocks. The people in the second quintile in that 30-plus year period, there was virtually no change in their income, so I'm going to leave that one the same. The people in the middle here, they had a small gain of 8%, so I'm going to be generous and add 1.5 blocks. No, wait, just one. I'm going to add one. There we go. Because it's almost one. Okay, and then the group here, this fourth quintile, they had a 20% gain. So they get 4 additional blocks in their income in this period. And then this highest group here, this top quintile, their income grew in this period by 49%. So they get 10 more blocks. This is how income changed between 1979 and 2012. Now, if we were to separate out this top quintile into just the top 5%, we're going to do that now. We're going to just imagine that this is the top 5%. So this is people who made $210,000 a year and up. They need to get 5 more blocks on top of this because their income grew by 75% during this period. And then if we were to separate this out even further to the top 1%, people who made $1.3 million a year or more, their income grew by 185%. So they need 22 more blocks, and I don't have 22 more blocks, but this equals about 5. So imagine here that we're going to stack these up. I had to use 2. There we go. And it's still too short, but that's kind of close, and I'm not even tall enough to reach. But if we were to put that on top, that's how much this group's income grew over that 30-plus year period. So we'll just put it side by side. And then if we were to break out that top 1% to the 0.1%, the very, very, very top, we'd have to add another 40 blocks on top of these because their income grew by 384% during this period. Now, we could do the same thing for the period that is measured preceding it from 1947 to 1979, but we won't. I'll just tell you that during that period, starting from 3 blocks, everybody's income grew across the quintiles somewhere between 86% and 116%. And that smaller number was at the top quintile, and that bigger number was down here at the smallest one. So that's what happened in the preceding 30 years. So this little visual representation makes it clear that inequality has been escalating in recent decades in ways that are very different from the decades preceding it. We've been talking about income, but we also need to note that wealth inequality has been growing too. Income is what we're paid. Wealth is what we own minus what we owe. So wealth is more concentrated now than at any time in the United States history since the 1920s. The top 10% of people in the United States own 74% of the wealth. So to imagine that I had 10 chairs up here. The top 10% owns a little more than 7 of those chairs, and everybody else gets the 2.5 plus chairs that are remaining to share amongst them. And that's in the United States. According to the most recent Oxfam report, the top 1% in the whole world owns 50% of the world's wealth. So those are just the facts of inequality, income inequality and wealth inequality. Those are just the facts, and representing them is the easy part. Making meaning of those facts and figuring out how to respond to them is much more difficult. I wanted to show those videos today so that we can try to keep in our minds and viscerally in our bodies what inequality looks like. And I invited Carolyn to share her responses because I want to encourage all of us to do the same. I want to encourage us to notice how we feel about the realities of economic inequality and to notice how our own feelings may be influenced by our personal socioeconomic history and experience. There are some people who say that this inequality isn't a bad thing. In fact, they say it's a good thing, and it's a good thing because it provides incentive for people to work and to strive. They say that wealth creation leads, they say that wealth creation for the most wealthy leads to job creation, which ultimately benefits the poor. And they say that wealth continues to trickle down so that when those at the top do better, it means that those at the bottom actually have more money than they would if the wealthy weren't so wealthy. I read others who say, and I myself believe, that this much inequality is a moral outrage. We considered early in our service the difference between fair and equal. Even within the inequality that is built into capitalism, my moral compass says that it isn't fair for some people to live with constant struggle and deprivation while others have more than they could possibly spend in multiple lifetimes. I believe that such vast income inequality is unjust, and it plays a big part in many of the other injustices of our day, including mass incarceration, undocumented migration, climate change, racism, and the oppression of girls and women worldwide. You don't have to look very far to find specific arguments about why high income inequality is unjust and just plain bad for society. In their book, The Spirit Level, that epidemiologists Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett argue that high income inequality is bad for our health, erodes public trust, and contributes to increasing rates of violence in society at large. And there is a very wide body of writing and research and reporting on the ways in which income inequality contributes to inequality in educational opportunity, which then leads to inequality in educational attainment, which then further contributes to income inequality. So the trouble is great and growing. What can we possibly do to make a difference? I think that educating ourselves is one faithful response. How did we get here? Why is this period so different from the decades that preceded it? There are lots of people who would like to answer that question, and I'll share the views of just one. Robert Reich is an economist who does a lot of work on these issues. He's the former Secretary of Labor and is now a professor and author, and a few years ago he made a documentary movie called Inequality for All. He says that globalization and technological change have contributed to the widening income inequality gap of recent decades. However, he also says that one of the major contributing forces has been the concentration of power by those at the very top. He says that wealth and power have enabled corporations and financial institutions to successfully lobby for changes in rules of the economic game in a way that has dramatic benefits for themselves. He says that things like expanded intellectual property rights, relaxed antitrust laws, reduced restrictions on banks, changes in securities laws and income tax laws have all enabled people with wealth to preserve and expand their wealth. Meanwhile, the reduction in the real value of wages, high levels of unemployment, and the weakening of labor unions, along with rising costs of health insurance, have all contributed to economic insecurity for millions. Reich observes that 50 years ago, GM was the largest employer in this country. And back then, adjusted for today's wages, the typical GM employee earned $35 an hour. Today, the largest employer in the country is Walmart, and the typical earner makes $9 an hour. Reich argues that people made the rules that have created this, and that people can change those rules with political will. He offers specific details about what changes he thinks would make the biggest difference. And if you want to learn more, check out his film or any of his works. There are a lot of economic theorists who'd like to answer that question. But I'd like to leave you today, instead of with economics, a little bit about theology. I attended the Meadville Lombard Theological School convocation this week as part of my work with our intern minister. The theme of the convocation was lamentation and resistance. The theology professor of the school, Mike Hoag, made a presentation on his observations of the life and work of the social activist and philosopher Grace Boggs, who just died this past October. For decades, she worked in Detroit to create a better world. Looking at her life's work, Mike concludes that rebellion is an event, but revolution is a process. To sustain the long-haul work, we need to be able to imagine a different future. We have to retain the ability to imagine. We need to tell stories and create images and sing songs and dream dreams of a better world. And then to find our way there, we have to be willing to experiment. Our ideas may not turn out the way we imagined, but we can learn from any outcome and let our learning shape our imagination and influence our dreams. Revolutions are never easy, but it is easy to be overwhelmed when trouble reigns. It's easy to give in to despair or to just distract ourselves because it's too complicated, so much. But theology offers us a way to keep the faith. In our tradition, our theological foundation is rooted in the inherent worth and dignity of every person and encompasses the interconnectedness of us all. So we sing songs of lamentation and despair in order to voice how we feel, and then we sing songs of stories of blessing to give us courage for the journey to help be a blessing. The way it is now is not the way it always was. We can learn from the past and we can imagine a better future. We can create a new way, not by ourselves and not with a single concerted effort. It's going to take something of a revolution, I think, to undo this vast income inequality we live with today. And our faith tradition has much to encourage us and sustain us if we're willing. So let us be willing. Amen. Yesterday, our religious education teachers and advisors and volunteers gathered for their winter retreat. It was an opportunity to develop some new skills, to do some planning for the spring, and to renew their commitments to the teaching, the faith formation of the young people in our congregation. That is one of the most important ministries we have in this congregation, helping instill faith in our young people so that they can bless the world today and for years to come. I send you with these words from the 19th century Unitarian minister Theodore Parker. BR is a religion which, like sunshine, goes everywhere. Its temple, all space. Its shrine, the good heart. Its creed, all truth. Its ritual, works of love. Its profession of faith, divine living. Go in peace.